Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants, indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news, sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about religion, a little bit about geology, a little bit about space and science. But I wanted to start off thinking about the idea of sacred places. For some reason, there are always central places that people want to go to and experience personally and stand in awe. I think about in the secular version, there are museums and stuff like this.
Oh, yeah.
When I went to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, I remember feeling a kind of church-like sensation, even though it was bonkers with people running all over and making all kinds of noise. I had this sense of like, I'm in a special place.
Oh, yeah.
This is a different place.
Yes, well, I think museums are a great example because I feel the same way about the Met in New York.
Oh, absolutely, you know? Yeah.
Like it's so just as a place, it's very much a place of pilgrimage for individuals who are interested in history and art and religion, and then you go in and you have all of these pieces that themselves are from all of these distant sacred places and sacred times.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's great. Like you get to go to it's almost like the catch net for sacred places throughout history. But when you go to a sacred place like this, these places that have a history, I almost feel like you are you're playing on the same kind of awe that you might experience if you went to and believed in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Somehow a kind of energy has collected there over time, and it gives you this sense of being part of history to be there.
Yeah, I mean we sort of map out our worlds with these pinpoints. That all the energy seems to converge around. And then when we visit those places, we're taking part in that energy. We have all these expectations and we're engaging in sort of the collective expectations of that place. Now, this is certainly something we've covered on Stuff to Blow Your Mind in the past, that being Stendhal syndrome or Jerusalem syndrome, the idea where when someone finally visits one of these places that means a lot to them personally, be it Jerusalem, be it, in the case of today's episode, Mecca, or be it just a museum or to stand before a particular piece of art that carries a lot of weight with you. You enter into it with all these expectations, and then you're finally there, and it can be overwhelming. It can be mentally overwhelming and physically overwhelming to actually be there at this linchpin of your life.
Yeah, despite having lived in the world your whole life, suddenly you feel that you have connected with again, this sense of history.
Like, yeah.
Here's a place that will continue to be visited and written about, and now I'm here.
Yeah. And it could be an historical cathedral. It could be Stonehenge. It could be a restaurant that was used as a filming location for a movie you like. But whatever it is, like, this is a place that has value, that seems to extend beyond your life.
Now, of course, we've been talking about, you know, our favorite secular examples, museums or whatever. But I'd say you probably have to amplify this feeling of importance connected to place even more so for religious believers and the sites that are sacred to their personal religious beliefs. And of course, one of the sites that is sacred to millions of people around the world will be found in Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
That's right. As far as sacred places go and the collective capital of belief that goes into attributing them as such, the Haram Mosque or the Grand Mosque in Mecca is easily one of the most sacred places on earth. As one of the five pillars of Islam, every able-bodied Muslim has to embark on a pilgrimage to Mecca. And this is known as the Hajj.
Right.
On the way, you conduct a series of rituals, including the stoning of the devil in Mina. And finally, you conduct seven revolutions within the Haram Mosque, circling the Holy Kaaba building, which is essentially this dark cube. It's featured in the art for this episode, and I'm sure everyone out there has seen images of it.
Of course, if you haven't, you should go look it up, because you should have this in mind. This dark stone building with tapestries draped on it, verses from the Quran, and then at one corner of the building, something very special.
Yeah, the eastern exterior corner includes something that is known as the Black Stone, or the Al-Hajir Al-Haswad. This is going to be the object that we're talking about here. As you pass it, you touch it if you can, you kiss it if you can. If you can't reach it, you point at it. But to touch the stone, it is said, is to enter into a contract with God. And I've seen translations that indicate that the Black Stone itself is the right hand of God on earth.
Now, later in this episode, we're going to be exploring what the Black Stone might be from a geological standpoint, what its history and significance is within the religion. But I guess first maybe we should just take a look at the site itself at large, the Kaaba.
Yeah, the Kaaba itself is a very holy place in Islamic tradition, and we're going to sort of divide between the mythic history, the religious ideas of what this is and where it came from, as well as what we actually know from history. But according to tradition, the Kaaba was constructed by Abraham, and its four corners align with the four compass points. It's made of great blocks of granite, but the holy black stone itself burns with an even greater mysticism. So this black stone here, that's set in this in cement and surrounded by silver here in the eastern corner of the Kaaba stone, it's not a single stone, or at least it's not actually a single stone anymore. Rather, it consists of eight pieces of various size, seemingly the same rock, seemingly of the same origin, and they're cemented together, surrounded by a silver frame. And the largest fragment is said to be about the size of a date.
So that's not very big.
Right. Yeah. As these things go. So sometimes you just hear about the Black Stone and you just imagine something larger.
I must say that I always thought, before reading about this, for the episode today, that it was a single stone. And I thought it was sort of like one very large jet black stone. And the reason for that is that there are not very good pictures of it out there.
That's right.
So generally this is not something that people photograph very much. The photographs of it that do exist are kind of sometimes grainy or low quality or from a distance. It's just not ideal documentation conditions, but
which is crazy considering this is probably one of the most viewed objects on the planet.
Yeah, it's amazing. it's something that, you know, millions and millions of people have personally laid eyes on. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to find a good picture of it. But yeah, so what you see in most of these pictures is there is this silver, it almost looks like a basin turned sideways or something. It's this silver collar. That's built into the corner of the building. And then inside this silver bowl, there is just this dark abyss.
Yeah.
Generally is all you can see from the outside. So if I had to guess before I'd started reading the research on it, what this was, I would think it was like a large piece of obsidian or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a large flat black surface that is smooth and dark, and people pass by and touch it and kiss it. But no, it turns out that there's actually a good bit more texture going on inside, which makes identifying the geology of the black stone all the more interesting.
Yeah, so the pieces that are set in the cement, they've been touched so many times, there's a smoothness to them.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting, like, these are pieces of something that was once whole, and we'll get into that in a bit. Various authors have commented on it and tried to, you know, there are varying figures that have come out over the years, over the centuries, really. Westerners getting a glimpse of it, looking at it, trying to figure out how big it is, the pieces are now, and how big it might have been when it was a one piece.
Mm-hmm.
There is a paper by Elizabeth Thompson, which we're going to refer to several times here. She was from the University of Copenhagen. She wrote a paper in Meteoritics in 1980 titled New Light on the Origin of the Holy Black Stone of the Kaaba. And she did some figuring here, and she says that the possible original size of the stone would have been 25 by 20 by 20 centimeters, or 9.8 inches by 7.8 by 7.8. Which would have made it, what, possibly about the size of a cantaloupe originally?
A big cantaloupe?
My rough estimate here.
I've never measured a cantaloupe, Robert.
Well, I did some – I was at home when I was doing this portion of the notes, and I was like, all right, well, how big is that? Let me think. Is that – what fruit does that align with?
Yeah.
And the best I can tell, possibly cantaloupe, fruit, or Islamic history experts may differ on that. Now – as for the color, this is another interesting thing, because again, you look at it, you just see darkness surrounded by silver. It's called the black stone.
So what color is it?
That is actually kind of difficult to decide on as well, because various accounts have described it as brownish black, or blackish brown, or reddish black, or deep reddish brown. And some accounts also speak to a coal-like matrix to it.
I think I've read that was only one account that actually said that.
Yeah, well, at least one account, then said coal-like matrix. But most accounts point out that they're yellow spots, pointed white crystals.
Yeah.
There's also an impossible interior that is described as gray.
Yeah.
So it's not just this obsidian or charcoal-like stone, but rather something that has, you know, flecks of other color in them.
Right. There are these little pieces of yellow or white. And then there are also some reports that inside the stone it is white, or that like covered parts of the stone that are not exposed in the cemented paved surface are white.
Mm-hmm.
Another claim we should probably deal with, because it does figure big into scientists trying to figure out what type of rock or mineral this is that it allegedly, according to very old reports, floats in water.
Yes, this is something that comes up a time or two in the historical record of the stone, where supposedly this was used to authenticate it after it had been stolen and returned. And we'll get into that story in a bit.
That was in like the 10th century.
So the idea that they could tell it's the stone by placing it in water and seeing if it would float.
Well, not many stones float, so that would be a unique identifier.
Yeah.
But I guess that does just depend on taking that story as accurate.
Right. And that's one of the problems, the challenges, the tantalizing aspects of this whole exercise in discussing what this stone actually consists of from a scientific standpoint, because you're left to draw on all these varying accounts. And very limited, observational data about the stone.
Yeah, I mean, one of the features of the stone – so one of the things about observing the stone that you have to understand is that is sort of the mechanics of how the ritual at the Kaaba works. Mm-hmm. People are constantly circling this, and there, you know, there might be thousands of people in there all trying to get up to the stone to kiss it or to point at it or to touch it. Mm-hmm. And so you are not in a situation where you can sit there and look at it and take notes.
Right. This is not a museum.
Right. No, it might be more like in the Louvre, where you try to get a good look at the Mona Lisa, but there's just people cramming in from all sides and pushing you. I've read reports about people trying to get a good look at the stone, and there are always reports mentioning just the crowd pushing you along, not being able to get up close to it. Or there are also guards there, and sometimes guards will push you along, move you out of the way. You can sort of understand why. I mean, they don't want to have a case of crowd crush or something like that with other people there.
Yeah, I mean, so and then on top of all of this, you have your sort of religious expectations. You have the whole Stendhal syndrome coming into play here as you're beholding it.
Now, Robert, I think you had a couple of accounts you were reading of people talking about visiting the Kaaba, right?
Yeah, I tend to find the idea of early Westerners visiting Mecca and seeing the Kaaba and the stone, I find those really fascinating. And so I just had mainly two here I wanted to highlight, and there's a third one that we end up referencing later. So the first one to reference here, Swiss traveler and Arabic speaker Johann Ludwig Burckhardt visited Mecca in 1814. So he was very much an Arabic speaker, enthusiast. He was he converted to Islam. Mm-hmm. This is also the guy who rediscovered the ruins of Petra, which,
oh, okay.
if you're still foggy on what Petra is, think to what Indiana Jones
and the Last Crusade. Yeah, is it the treasury building of Petra that's
the one set in the cliff wall? Yeah,
the Tomb of the Grail there, mm-hmm. or not the tomb, the resting the booby trap place.
Yes, the booby trap place with all the Grail stuff. In reality, of course, that is Petra, and this guy
does not have booby traps.
Does not have booby traps. No, one of the most notable individuals, one of my favorites to visit Mecca in early times as a Westerner, is Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton. He visited in 1853. And Burton was also allegedly a convert to Islam, an earlier possible convert to Hinduism. He's a difficult guy to pin down. It sounds like I'm being vague here. So he spoke 25 distinct languages, not counting dialects. He was something of a bisexual hedonist, a spy, an explorer. He was endlessly fascinated with other cultures, languages, modes of human sexuality. And he's probably – some commentators classify him more as an atheist, but his explorations into Hinduism and Islam are often referred to as conversions.
Like he didn't just study them. He became them.
Yeah. Like that's kind of my read on him. Like here's a guy who learned all these languages, and in using these languages, you kind of have to change the way your brain operates. And even to fake – if you were to assume, okay, someone like Burton, they just faked Islamic belief in order to go on the Hajj. Like to fake that, you would still have to be so versed in a deep understanding of the culture, the rites entailed there. Like your cover would be so deep. Mm-hmm. How would you keep it from overcoming you?
I mean, in one sense, it almost, you almost want to say that to fully understand someone else's religion, you almost have to be able to mentally convert to it in a kind of hypothetical sense to try to see what it looks like from the inside.
Right. And then at the same time, like Burton, again, is a fascinating character. We can't get into everything he did here, but he wrote a lot about his travels and his ideas and his observations. And at times he kind of waffles back and forth. Sometimes he sounds, you know, very much, at one with Islam and intrigued by it. Other times you still see some of that English colonial mentality rising to the surface, and he sounds a bit dismissive. Like I said, very, very fascinating guy, difficult guy to nail down. But here's a quick quote from his writings about beholding the stone. He said, "After thus reaching the stone, despite popular indignation testified by impatient shouts, we monopolized the use of it for at least 10 minutes.
Whoa.
Yeah. which is quite a lot when you see the crowd pictures, right? Whilst kissing it and rubbing hands and forehead upon it, I narrowly observed it and came away persuaded that it is an aerolite. Other travelers, including Burkhart, had thought it volcanic in origin.
Right. So here we're starting to get to the question of what the stone is geologically. A lot of commentators throughout the years have assumed that it was lava of some kind, basalt, things like that. But here's the idea that it's an aerolite, that it is a type of meteorite, a space rock.
Right. And to understand why this idea is so appealing, we have to discuss the mythic, the religious history of the stone a little bit. So if you dive into Islamic tradition and Islamic belief, there is a basic kind of Adamic origin story in play here. So depending on how you interpret this origin story, the Black Stone dates back to either Abraham or Adam, the first created human.
Okay.
So one interpretation is that Adam built the first Kaaba on Earth, and here he sat on a white stone, okay, a stone that turned black with the fall of man. And the first Kaaba was then destroyed in the Great Flood, and it wasn't until later that Abraham was tasked with rebuilding it or building the first Kaaba, depending on the telling.
Uh-huh.
Another idea here is that this was a meteorite brought to Abraham by the archangel Gabriel from the mountainside where it had fallen, or that it originally was one of the stars of paradise.
Yeah.
Now, one of the reasons they're kind of varying takes on this is because the black stone, as I understand it, is not actually mentioned in the Quran. It is it comes from additional Islamic sources and just sort of traditions.
To me, that's always some of the most interesting things you find in any religion is the stuff that's not necessarily straight in the middle of the canon, but not necessarily out of the mainstream canon either. It's sort of like it comes from additional traditional material, the metadata of the religion.
Right. I think we've touched on this before, discussions of heaven, hell, and purgatory in Christian and Catholic traditions and where those ideas come from.
Yeah.
Because certainly if you're looking for a strict definition of those things within the Old or New Testament, those details are not really forthcoming.
No, you get a few hints, but you're not going to find Dante in the Bible.
Right. Now, in terms of what the stone does, I already mentioned that it's considered the right hand of God. To touch it is to enter into a contract with God.
Uh-huh.
And there are additional powers that have been attributed to it. Oh, and I believe this comes from the writings of one Heinrich von Maltzen,
well,
who visited the Mecca as well in 1858, coming after the two individuals we already mentioned.
Supposedly. So von Maltzen, I want to be careful about citing him because he strikes me as perhaps unreliable and definitely unsympathetic. Like, okay. He wrote this 1865 book in German called Meine Wallfahrt nach Mekka, which means My Pilgrimage to Mecca. The book's in German. I've not found an official published translation, but using Google Translate, I did a little looking through this book, and he strikes me as an sort of unsympathetic and perhaps uncomprehending outsider. So I wouldn't use him as a very reliable account of what the people on the Hajj in the 19th century were actually believing. But he at least claims, possibly wrongly, that the pilgrims at the time believed that it was impossible to destroy the Kaaba and impossible to destroy the Black Stone itself. So he said that, you know, they were attributing these miraculous powers to it. Now, I know, you know, within every religion, there's always going to be plenty of diversity of opinion and different ideas. But I know one strong tradition in Islam, probably not adhered to by all Muslims, is the idea that, you know, that there aren't miraculous objects, you know, that, that essentially people aren't going to do miracles for you. Objects aren't going to be miraculous.
Right.
But if this account is correct, there are at least some slightly miraculous properties attributed to the stone at some points in history. But then again, as I say, this guy kind of seems like a jerk and like he's maybe not understanding things correctly. Like he seems disgusted by the rituals. He doesn't at one point he's like, I had to go and kiss the stone, and he calls it the monster.
Oh, So he is perhaps not looking at the stone from the perspective of an outsider who has converted to Islam and is fully accepting any of the ideas and traditions around it.
Yeah, or even just trying for the sake of understanding to get into that headspace.
Right.
What does this mean to the insider, to the believer?
And then as far as the future is concerned, there are tales that on the day of judgment, it is said that the stone will grow eyes, mouth, and tongue, and that it will see and speak, and it will witness in favor of all those who touched it with sincere hearts. Which I think is
wow.
Quite a visual. That one kind of gives me chill bumps, the idea of the stone sort of becoming this floating face that then speaks on behalf to God of those who actually touched it and entered into that contract with it.
Not just a mouth, but a tongue.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, maybe we should take a break.
Yeah.
And then when we do, we can discuss a little bit more about the supposed history of this stone and then get into some of the geological ideas about what it is and where it came from.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back. So the stone, the black stone here, it actually predates Islam. So it was there when Muhammad the Prophet came into Mecca.
And this is a fact that's acknowledged by Islamic tradition, not contrary to it, right?
Right, right. Yeah, this is pretty settled as far as I understand it. So in Persian legend, it was supposedly a symbol of the planet Saturn. That was a tidbit I read in Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. Now, according to Oliver C. Farrington's writings in 1900, he wrote an article, The Worship and Folklore of Meteorites. He says that the worship of this stone by Arabian tribes is first spoken of by Greek writers of early times. And the Kaaba definitely existed as a shrine as early as 200 CE, and the black stone was part of it. So this would have been, you know, a shrine that entailed venerated objects devoted to different deities.
Right.
And among them was the black stone.
Yeah. And so, like, having idols there, like, I know part of the Islamic tradition is the idea of removing the idols from the Kaaba, right?
Right. And that's exactly what happened in 630 CE. That's when the Prophet entered Mecca, purged the Kaaba of idols, reportedly destroying something like 360 idols. But as often is the case with holy places in history, the Kaaba and the stone retained their sacred aspects. We see this in Islamic history all the time as well, such as the function of the Greek Parthenon as a mosque during Ottoman occupation.
Mm-hmm.
This was something I really didn't know a lot about until recently when I attended a talk at Emory University.
Wow.
It was converted into a mosque, the Parthenon, and then when the Parthenon was partially destroyed, you had sort of the gutted Parthenon, and in the middle they had this kind of cubicle mosque that actually reminds one a little bit of the Kaaba.
Wow,
yeah,
that's fascinating. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, now there was a lot of turmoil even during Muhammad's life. Muhammad lived 570 through 632. And the Kaaba was burnt during this time, and this may have caused some of the fragmentation that we see. That's the thing. We don't know exactly when this fragmentation of the stone occurred.
Yeah, this history of the stone as an object becoming many objects does seem kind of fuzzy. Like, there's this general idea that it was once a single stone or fewer number of stones and then broke into smaller parts. And then now there are apparently fewer visible pebbles in the stone than there were, say, in the 19th century.
Right. And one of the ideas here is that the pieces could either have been removed or lost, or they could still be there. We just can't see them all that well because, A, we can't really see the stone fragments all that well anyway, or they might be partially obscured by the cement and the silver and repeated attempts to, you know, hold everything together.
Right. So what were the circumstances under which it was burned?
So this was during the civil war between the Caliph Abd al-Malik and Ibn Zubayr, who controlled Mecca at the time. The Kaaba was set on fire. This would have been 683. And reported by some accounts, the black stone broke into three pieces and then was reassembled with silver. So that's an opportunity, let's say, for the stone to have been broken, certainly. Now, another opportunity that comes up is in 930. And that's when Mecca was sacked by the Carmathians, led by Abu Tahr al-Janabi, who apparently used the Hajj as an excuse to demand entry into the city with his troops. Now, a number of you are probably wondering, well, who are the Carmathians? They were an heretical sect of Islam that considered the Quran allegory. They refuted various rites and entailed a mix of Islamic and Persian mysticism. They sacked and looted Mecca. They desecrated holy sites. They massacred pilgrims around the Kaaba and removed the black stone and took it out of Mecca, apparently in hopes of moving the destination of the Hajj to Hajar in what we now call Bahrain.
So they were trying to get everybody to come to them from now on.
That is how I understand it. Yeah, based on the material I was reading, this ended up not working. all that well. And I mean, it's also worth noting here that, of course, history is written by the victors. So, you know, to what extent is some of this colored by the fact that even though the Carmathians were very powerful at the time, they ended up fading into history.
Right.
So they tried to change the point of the Hajj. It didn't work. The Black Stone is returned to Mecca around 951 or 952, but for a hefty ransom fee.
Well, now hold on a second. How do you know it's really the stone when you return it?
Well, you got to test its buoyancy, right? You've got to see if it floats in water, and apparently it did.
So that's where this idea comes from, right? In the 10th century that this was returned, and one thing that was known about the stone somehow was that it would float in water.
Yes. And some accounts indicate that it was returned and shattered into pieces. So whether it was shattered during extraction or during the return, that's kind of, you know, up in the air. Now, there's an additional account that is sometimes brought up as a possible incident in which it was shattered, and that's around 1050. The Caliph Al-Hakim Bayamir Allah allegedly sent an agent to smash the stone, but this only inflicted slight damage, and the agent was killed on the spot. Who's to say? I only found one account where someone was speculating on the nature of the stone who thought that this might have been an incident that could have resulted in serious damage.
Mm-hmm.
And the details on these accounts were from Mecca, A Literary History of the Muslim Holy Land by Francis E. Peters. So if any of these didn't do the trick, though, there was also a 1626 flood that toppled three of the Kaaba walls. So
that also could have contributed to the fracturing of the Black Stone.
Right. So if you have an object that is susceptible to damage and it plays such a vital role for such a long period of time,
yeah,
there's a high possibility it's going to result in damage.
You know, one of the other things we should mention is that this is a stone that you can quite well expect to be undergoing a certain amount of wear and tear.
Oh, yeah.
With millions of people from around the world coming to this stone and trying to touch it and kiss it. I mean, there's all manner of which, you know, handling of things leads to their deterioration over time. Even if you think you're being gentle, I mean, there's a reason museums don't let you touch stuff.
Right. Like what if the Statue of David, what if everyone got to touch David?
Yeah.
You know, that would erode the statue over time. And certainly, accounts of the Black Stone indicate that there is a certain amount of erosion that has taken place, a smoothing of the stones from all of that, all of those human touches, all of those kisses, all of that, the oil from human skin.
Yeah. But one can imagine that, I don't know, all manner of various handling, touching and stuff like that could also maybe have contributed to fracturing. I mean, it wouldn't have to be a highly destructive event. Even gentle caresses over the centuries can add up.
Yeah, indeed. All right, and that basically brings us up to modern times. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to discuss the possible scientific origins of the stone. What is it? Where did it came from? And how limited are we in our ability to answer that question?
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So we're going to be talking about scientific inquiry into the geologic nature of the Black Stone of the Kaaba. What kind of rock is it?
Yeah.
Did it come from space? Did it come from Earth? What's it made of? And there's one thing we should note at the outset here, which is that it is hard to know the answer to this question because the rock has not been removed to a scientific lab,
right,
where you can do tests on it. This is one of these strange situations where people are trying to do science from a distance, mm-hmm. sort of through the intermediary of people's subjective accounts.
Right. Yeah. Scientists have not examined the Black Stone, and really scientists are probably not going to get to analyze the Black Stone at any point in the foreseeable future. Like I kind of have to think of sci-fi scenarios in which the Black Stone could possibly be analyzed. They're simply like, why would you do it? Why would you allow it? Why would you submit it for scientific analysis? Mm-hmm. There's really nothing quite like the Black Stone in any other religious tradition that I can think of. Like,
I mean, yeah,
an object that is so central, like literally central, to the belief system. Like the closest thing I can think of in Christian and specifically Catholic traditions is the Shroud of Turin. Mm-hmm. But even that is not. I would not say the Shroud of Turin is an article of faith or in any way associated with a pillar of Christianity.
Yeah, there are definitely in other religions holy objects, holy sites, but I feel like nothing as central as this and right. as hard to get at.
Yeah,
as hard to get at in a scrutinizing way. Obviously, it's not hard to get at just in general in that, like we said, millions of people go and touch and look at this thing, but you can't remove it. You can't take it away with you and you can't spend some time scrutinizing it.
Right. So we end up with generally intellectuals, geologists, looking at pictures such as they are, looking at sketches, analyzing descriptions of it, mm-hmm. and then using their knowledge of material sciences to try and figure out what it could be.
Which can be very interesting. So one of the standard things, this is probably not a very interesting hypothesis, but for, you know, years people have said, well, it's probably some kind of lava or basalt, something like that. Mm-hmm. Generally now people don't think that's the answer.
Right.
So another one of the main theories that's been offered over the years is that the Black Stone is meteoritic
yes.
in origin, that it came from space.
And, it makes sense, right? Because this aligns with the cosmic origins that are presented in the mythic history mm-hmm. as a gift of a primordial god. What better origin than outer space, right? And there's also a long history of two important factors here. One,
the worship or at least veneration of meteorites, and two, the use of meteoric iron.
Now, I think a lot of Muslims would probably want to emphasize the distinction that the Kaaba stone is not something that is worshipped,
Correct. But
it's a more like symbolic object that is playing a role in what they would describe as their relationship with God. But even if the object is not itself a point of worship, you can easily see how objects that fall from space would take on some kind of sacred or venerable dimension.
Yeah, like one cool example of this is that Native Americans from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde community of Oregon continue to make annual ceremonial visits to the famous Willamette meteorite at the American Museum of Natural History.
Oh, back to that.
Yeah. So while scientists believe the rock is the iron core of a shattered planet, the Clackamas tribes people knew it as Tamanowas, a representative of the sky people and a source of healing and cleansing.
I mean, if you look at a picture of this meteorite, and you should, yeah, it looks like something that was sent by the gods. Of course it does. This thing looks insane. It's got these caverns in it. Robert, do you know what it looks like?
I've seen pictures, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like you get a sense of topography, like it's a maze, or even like a former living thing. There are like coral aspects to it.
Yes. It looks like a large piece of iron, parts of which have come alive and slithered away.
Now, the iron is interesting, too, because that comes back to this use of meteoric iron. Mm-hmm. So before mining technology allowed for the ready harvesting of iron ore, one of the few sources of this durable metal was bits of it that plummeted from the sky in the form of meteorites. The ancient Egyptians knew about it. They dubbed it black copper.
Oh, that's a cool name.
It is. It's very, very, very cool. And it's generally spread thin across vast distances. You're going to find little bits of it here and there. So
right.
It was a rare commodity. You could not.
You cannot arm an army with it.
Correct. You couldn't make enough swords for an army, but you could make, if you, scratch enough of it together, you could make a single sword and it would have, obviously it would have holy or at least, ceremonial significance.
Mm-hmm.
So this relegated most meteoric iron creations to the realm of decorative or significance or ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in Islamic history, the 7th century caliphs were said to have brandished swords made from meteoric iron, while such iconic figures as Attila the Hun and Tamerlane reportedly wielded other cosmic blades against their enemies. And, also there are bowls, plows, and stirrups that have been observed to have been made from it as well. So maybe sometimes you just ended up making what you needed out of the iron. But for the most part, it tended to take on a sacred significance.
Weapons from space.
Yeah.
That should be a whole episode on its own sometime. Is there enough there? Could we do it?
Weapons from space?
I mean, has anybody ever tried to make what do you call it? A morning star?
I don't know. Why would you make a morning star out of it when you could make a sword? Terry Pratchett, by the way, before he died, I believe had obtained a sword made from meteoric iron.
No, what I meant was make a morning star with a moon rock.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like the idea. Yeah. Who does that? I mean, if you have to be brained to death with a medieval blunt weapon, why not moon rock?
Yeah.
Makes it a little special. So it's easy to fall into this thinking, all right, it's a meteorite, maybe it's meteoric iron, and that's why all the significance is given to it. However, as Thompson points out,
we mentioned her earlier,
yeah.
Elizabeth Thompson.
Yes, as she points out, this isn't necessarily a slam dunk theory. An iron meteorite, she wrote, would not break into fragments, nor would it float in water because it is a piece of iron.
Yeah.
But that doesn't rule out all meteorites. There's also the idea that it's a stony meteorite. But would a stony meteorite float in water? Would it be able to withstand centuries of human erosion? Probably not.
Yeah. So here I think we should actually get into a few of the papers that have been published on this subject. And the first big one that tried to get at the after the meteorite theory had been dominant for a long time in the 20th century. The first one that I think really tried to dig in and look at the descriptions and figure out what it could be was in 1974 in the journal Meteoritics. And so they're looking at it and saying, okay, pretty much everybody thinks this thing's a meteorite. Are they onto something or are they wrong? And this was by Robert Dietz and John McCone. And in this paper, Dietz and McCone argued that the Kaaba stone, the black stone, is probably not a meteorite, but an agate. So why do they get to agate? Well, let's follow them through their reasoning. So first of all, they say the fact that it appears to have been cracked and fractured, as you mentioned earlier, Robert, sort of rules out the possibility that it's a nickel iron meteorite. You've seen these types of meteorites before that are essentially like a big metal sponge. You know, if you have tryptophobia, these things really should set you off with these patterns of holes. But a nickel iron meteorite, it's not brittle like most earth rocks. It's more like a piece of metal. And thus we would not expect to see a meteorite like this with a crack or cracked into multiple pieces. But they say, okay, well, maybe it could be a stony meteorite. This is a different kind of meteorite. It's more like earth rocks. And from descriptions, the stone, they say, is, quote, hummocky and muscled. So what does this mean and why is it relevant? Well, hummocky, that's not just like a cute British word or something, though. It does kind of sound like, you know, Lord Hummocky Twizzleton.
I was thinking it sounds like a great description for a wine. So I go, what do you think of this particular wine's bouquet? Well, it's hummocky and muscled. Well, muscled wine.
Yeah. With notes of elderberry.
Yeah.
So hummocky actually means something in geology. It means highly uneven or irregular in surface. So they say, you know, literally millions of people have touched this thing over the centuries, and yet they haven't worn away these apparent irregular features of the surface of the stone. So for that to be the case, the authors suggest that the stone needs to have a pretty good Mohs scale rating, which they estimate should be a minimum of a 7. So you know about the Mohs scale, right? That's how Mo you answer.
From Simpsons? Yes.
No, M-O-H, okay. The Mohs scale, geological hardness scale. It's how you rate how hard is it. You want to know how hard it is, you give a Mohs scale rating. And a 10 on the Mohs scale is a diamond. That's super hard. I think talc is like a 1 or a 2.
Okay.
A 7 is quartz. So they think for this thing to have withstood all of the touching and kissing over the years and still have this uneven, hummocky surface, it needs to be at least a 7 on the Mohs scale. So that gives them one clue to work with. Another conclusion from the descriptions is that the black stone supposedly has this highly reflective, almost mirror-like polish. You know, you can put your makeup on in it.
I would advise against doing that.
No, I don't know. People probably would not have the patience for that. No, and you probably actually couldn't. But they say that it is almost mirror-like. It's highly reflective. And they claim that this indicates the stone must be, aphanitic and monomineralic. Oh God, more terminology. So what does that mean? Aphanitic is a geology term that means very fine-grained minerals. So aphanitic rocks are those where you can't see the individual mineral crystals with the naked eye. And this usually happens in igneous rocks, you know, fire-formed rocks that are formed from molten rock cooling and solidifying pretty quickly. You know, that often happens near the surface. One common example would be basalt. The other word was monomineralic. That means exactly what it sounds like. Rocks that are made of just one type of mineral. If the rock is aphanitic and monomineralic, they think it's more likely that it could be polished down to this reflective surface by people touching it over the years. Already, though, I think we should note, this is something we sort of warned about earlier, the awkwardness of doing science this way. Because listen to what's going on. They're having to work from secondhand descriptions of the features of the stone without examining it themselves. So there's just a lot of room for problems to creep into this kind of analysis. So we should definitely take their conclusions with a large crystal grain of salt. Anyway, to continue, How about the color of the stone? Can that tell us anything about it? Well, their description says, you know, it's called the Black Stone. The stone's black, maybe even jet black.
Okay.
Now, they don't know whether black is the original color of the stone or whether it has turned black through handling.
Because, again, the mythic idea here is that it was originally white and human sin has turned it black or mostly black. And this on top of the differing opinions of just how black it actually is now.
Right.
You referenced earlier.
Yeah. And so back when this article was first published, the authors managed to get in contact with the keeper of the Kaaba, who in turn got a Muslim scholar named Muhammad Alwi to offer a sort of concurrently published reply that gives some theological and historical context to their article. And this scholar had the among his claims, I guess, is the idea that the stone was originally white. He goes with that idea. And he says various descriptions have called it, quote, whiter than snow, as white as silver, or charmingly as white as yogurt.
Oh, okay.
And I guess what they have in mind is not that gray purple Trix yogurt that.
Oh, goodness. I forgot about Trix yogurt.
Trix yogurt.
Yogurt in name only.
Why would you make gray yogurt? That is a crime against nature.
Yeah. I mean, the fruit needs to stay on the bottom, uh-huh, or is added after the fact. It should not come pre-mixed.
Ugh. Yeah. Okay. Tricks are for kids, I guess. Anyway, one explanation for the change in color, if in fact what happened is that it was originally white and it darkened over time, is that whenever the pieces of the stone become loosened or dislodged from the inset over the years, you know, they start to come out of the cement, they were reattached with this kind of putty or cement made by kneading together wax, musk, and ambergris.
Ah, from whales.
Yeah. And so exposure to this putty is said to have turned the stones black over time. And supposedly the historian Ibn Nafi al-Khazai, while writing a history of the Kaaba, got to see the stone inset completely exposed while the Kaaba was being rebuilt, so out of the frame where it's usually kept. And he reported that the part of the stone usually kept covered by the wall, the part that's usually hidden, is white.
Huh.
So if he's correct about that, then it's not just a jet black stone, but a white stone that is either black on one part that's exposed or has turned black over time due to possibly multiple factors. But in any case, if the stone were originally black, it could be a type of stony meteorite, such as chondrite. Chondrite is a stony meteorite. And remember that the stony meteorite's different from that solid metal sponge meteorite, the iron nickel meteorite. But then again, a chondrite meteorite probably would not have been able to maintain its, quote, hummocky character with all those years of rubbing. So you put a stony meteorite in there, people touch it for 1,000 years, mm-hmm, it would get ground down. And the authors also say that a chondrite meteorite probably would not be described as having a mirror-like reflective polish. Now, here's one other option. How about a howardite meteorite?
Hmm.
Good name again. Howardites, the authors don't think it's going to be that because howardites are very rare. They think it's an unlikely candidate. Also, howardite tends to be light colored, and this would not fit in with an originally black Kaaba stone. But then it might fit if the stories of original whiteness are true. So a little bit more. Some legends about the stone point to the possibility of it being a sapphire or an amethyst, which is interesting. But the authors think neither of those minerals really fit. Sapphires are not big enough to be, you know, the date-sized pebbles we see now.
Mm-hmm.
And amethysts are, they say, quote, too readily cleaved. I'm not quite sure I understand why that would disqualify it. Maybe they're saying that it doesn't meet the hardness characteristics. It just come apart.
Yeah, because you gotta have to have a sweet spot here between something that is hard enough to withstand all that human erosion, but mm-hmm, also can
could
be
have
shattered.
Been fractured. Yeah. And so I don't know. It sounds like what you would want is something that is readily cleaved, but is not ground down by touching.
Yeah, maybe they mean it would have just it just is too fragile. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. So what do they conclude? Well, the authors suggest the simplest explanation would be to think of visually attractive stones that are somewhat unusual, but also not things that are considered precious gems. So they say obsidian might fit, but they say it's too brittle and delicate to have survived the years of handling and abuse that the cobblestone has. And in the end, they settle on agate. They think agate is the most likely candidate, especially black agate. Why? Well, it's monomineralic. It's hard, a Mohs scale 7. It's tough, and it's fine-grained, meaning aphanitic, that fun word from earlier. So agate, when polished by years of rubbing, should also show a fairly reflective surface, you know, kind of mirror-like. One last thing that they cite in their favor, they cite an anonymous Arab geologist who went to view the stone for himself while he was on the Hajj, and the scholar said that he observed what's called diffusion banding within the Kaaba stone. If you've ever looked inside a cross-section of an agate, you see these things that are kind of like tree rings, mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking yeah. about? And these are the bands, diffusion banding. And the authors claim that this would be consistent with the stone being an agate. One note is they seem absolutely unconcerned with or unaware of the idea that the stone maybe should float.
Yes, and that's something that Elizabeth Thompson mm-hmm. commented on when in her paper, which right. came afterwards. She argued that this choice, the agate, wouldn't float, and it also lacked a cosmic origin story. Now, personally, I think that last bit especially is short-sighted, because I think human history shows us that an object or place need not be verifiably heaven-touched to resonate with cosmic potency.
Yeah, I'm not very convinced by that either. I don't see why you couldn't conclude that a regular earth rock was a supernatural gift from heaven.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't literally have to come from space for people to venerate it as a gift from heaven.
Yeah, because, I mean, essentially you could boil it down to two different ways of looking at this stone and its origin. Either it was a really cool-looking stone that someone came across and it kind of went from there, mm-hmm. or it was a perfectly normal stone, but there was enough capital of belief that was put into it, mm-hmm. be it something situational or just the right people saying, this is it. This is tied to something larger than ourselves. I mean, you can just look around your house and you can find examples of two of those things in action, right? I'm on my desk right now. I have just a normal, like, gravel rock. I don't know, probably it came from asphalt or something. Mm. But my son brought it to me one day and wanted me to keep it because it was special. It's not special. It doesn't look special at all. But the fact that he gave
it to
me makes
it so. Did you
tell him that? No. I took it, and for the life of me, I can't quite get rid of it because I have this small attachment to it.
Right.
And likewise, we all have various doodads around where we have, you know, be it a stone or some minor decoration, where it just looks too interesting to get rid of.
Well, I think maybe now we should go to the next paper, the one we've been talking about several times already, that of Elizabeth Thompson, who has a different theory about where this stone comes from. And her theory is an interesting hybrid, I think, or I guess we should say it's a hypothesis. It's an interesting hybrid mm-hmm. of the meteoric or the meteoritic origin story and dealing with some of the problems with that.
Right. So as you can tell by that earlier criticism she had, she puts a lot of stock in the cosmic origin aspect, that this is somehow connected to a meteorite. However, it need not be an actual meteorite, according to her theory. It could be what is known as impactite glass.
Hmm. So I've attached for Robert, for you to look at here, a couple of pictures of Wabar impactite glass. So cool looking.
Yeah,
I wish I had some of this.
These look super cool. Yeah, and there are examples. Maybe we'll try to include some links to these images on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. Because they are kind of – how would you describe them?
I was trying to think of the best way to put this. They don't look like normal rocks. They do look, again, sort of like the iron meteorite. They look like something that could plausibly have come from a supernatural realm. They look sort of like a fistful of cottage cheese was wrapped up in a bunch of seaweed, in a wad of seaweed, and then turned into stone by a witch.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially, the idea here, I'll get into it more, but imagine what happens when a meteorite impact occurs in a sandy region, all right?
Okay, so there's silica sand.
Mm-hmm. And what happens when sand is heated up?
turns to glass.
Yeah. So Thompson points to the meteorite impact craters of a region known as Wabar. This is 684 miles or 1,100 kilometers from Mecca, so it's reasonably close.
It's in the Rub al-Khali Desert.
Yeah. And here, several iron meteorites have turned up, but the bedrock here is pure pale sandstone composed mostly of quartz. Crater walls are composed of block glass that are formed from fused silica and infused with billions of spherules of nickel and iron.
So this is impactite glass.
Yeah, and it occurs in what they call porous bombs. and often with a white interior and a glossy black shell, sometimes as black droplets. So she theorizes that the observed yellow-white specks in the stone are remnants of glass and or sandstone, and that the hardness of the glass would make it resistant to all of that human erosion. Meanwhile, the porous nature of the glass would make it float.
Hmm.
And that the black color would be due to the nickeliferous iron spherules captured from an explosion of nickel and iron. And she adds that these qualities match up with other examples of Wabar glass, as well as reports of meteorites used as memorials to the prophet.
Now, I think this is a really interesting theory. I might be sort of favoring it just because I love the pictures of this impactite glass so much.
Yeah.
It looks really cool. It looks so cool. I want this to be the answer.
Yes, it very much matches up with that classification of, I mean, you can imagine somebody coming across this stone and realizing this looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story of this?
It's also, I'm persuaded by, not persuaded, I shouldn't say that. I'm unfairly biased by this being a very geologically cool origin story,
mm-hmm.
that an object from the heavens came down and literally melted the earth.
Yes.
To form these objects that later become objects of reverence. One thing that's probably not necessarily, I don't know, an influence, but just a very interesting legendary parallel is the idea of the destruction of the city of Iram of the Pillars by fire from heaven.
Yeah, I've seen this referred to as the Atlantis of the Sands.
Yeah, Iram.
Because it's a, you know, it's a lost city, and
I think it's also called, is it Ubar? Is that right?
I'm not sure. I've seen it referred to as either Iram with an I or Aram with an A, at least in the copy of the Quran that I was looking at, because it is mentioned in the Quran, chapter 89, verse 6 to 14. It reads, "Hast thou not considered how thy Lord dealt with Ad of Aram, having lofty buildings, the like of which are not created in the land, and of Thamud, who hewed out rocks in the valley, and the Pharaoh, the Lord of hosts, who exceeded limits in the cities and made great mischief therein? So thy Lord poured on them a portion of chastisement. Surely thy Lord is watchful."
Whoa.
Yeah.
All right. So Thompson has made an interesting speculation here that it could be this impactite glass. But there was another scientific paper on it by H.J. Axon, published in the Journal of Material Science Letters in 1982, called "The Black Stone of Kaaba: Suggestions as to Its Constitution." And he looks at the research we've already talked about and tries to draw some conclusions from it, critique it, and then offer some ideas of his own. So he reacts to that original discussion of Dietz and McCone, who said it was an agate. And so he says, okay, their reasoning rests on some assumptions that the stone is jet black, that it's mirror-like in reflective power,
mm-hmm.
And that it's got these apparent banded regions that their friend the geologist saw when he went and visited it, that they attribute to diffusion banding, so it makes them think agate. On this basis, they say that it's not a stony meteorite of the chondrite variety because those crumble too easily. And the word here is friable. They're too easily friable. So they're looking for something that's aphanitic and monomineralic. You remember that? And they conclude that it's agate. But Axon claims that even though agate is readily available in the Middle East, he thinks the authors overlooked the importance of the fact that the stone is a collection of pebble-like fragments cemented together rather than a single stone with a well-preserved hummocky surface. So he thinks that they may be sort of mistaking the textured appearance of this cemented together piece of pavement, essentially,
mm-hmm.
for the surface of what a stone itself should look like.
Oh, okay.
And in defense of stony meteorites, he says, okay, chondrites, those are stony meteorites. They actually vary a whole lot in exactly how crumbly they are. You know, some of them might be more crumbly than others, how friable they are. Also, Axon says, you know, chondrites that have been subjected to what he calls extraterrestrial shock, which is also the medical condition induced by watching the movie Mac and Me. He says they, quote, tend to be compacted and contain dark veins, which might be mistaken for banding under unfavorable conditions of observation. So he says, you know, if you're just coming up at this thing in the middle of the day and you're trying to peek in at it, you might mistake these veins that we would often see in certain types of chondrites for the kind of banding you'd see in an agate. So that's in defense of it being a meteorite. On the other hand, against the chondrite hypothesis, Axon says it's common for chondrites to have these metallic iron nickel pieces distributed evenly throughout, which should be obvious when you look at this thing. This is something that people would have observed about it. On the other hand, he says that metal can disappear by way of oxidation, i.e. rusting, if exposed to your earth weather for long periods of time. So maybe it's just rusting, but if this were the case, you'd expect to see rust. You'd expect to see like a reddish hue on the stone.
Now, that being said, some accounts have said brownish or reddish.
So. Yeah, and here we get back to the problem with like combining all these different accounts that seem to differ from one another. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know which one to go on if you're trying to draw the best conclusions. But yeah, I have seen that too. Some people say reddish brown, others say black. So that's a little confusing. But also he says we would expect to see in a chondrite, quote, light colored chondrules of silicate. So what is that? Well, the chondrules are these visually striking, colorful, spherical minerals that are found in some meteorites. You should look this up. Go Google search chondrules. They have a distinctive appearance, and people would probably have noticed and reported them if they'd been present in the stone, because they're these like colored spheres. You would see them. So Axon says, okay, what about a carbonaceous meteorite? These are rare chondrites that are low in density. They're free of obvious metal particles. And sometimes they don't have these big chondrules that are really obvious. But these are rare meteorites. They're not a major candidate. And Axon thinks, maybe we should just keep them in the back of the mind.
You know, in we've had two different authors here discuss like rarity being an issue. I keep thinking, though, we're talking about a rare stone, in no classification.
It's not like
the black stone
and
everyday stone.
35 of these.
Yeah. Like this is a singular stone. So can we really count out the possibility of rare meteorites?
Well, I mean, it lowers the probability that anybody in history would have found one of these things, but it maybe increases the probability that if they had found it, they would have kept it and revered it.
Yeah.
So you're just sort of like adjusting the selection dials in two different ways. What about Thomson's hypothesis? He comes to that, you know, that it's this fused silica glass. There's an impact event in the sand in the desert. A bunch of sand gets melted along with some pieces of the meteorite into these crazy wads of spinach and cottage cheese, turned into stone. Well, Thomson, obviously, as we said, likes this hypothesis because it means the stone could feasibly float, and there are those stories from the past of it floating in brine or water or even concentrated brine. Mm-hmm. And this would also explain the white stone inside the black stone. But Axon says it's hard to see how a large piece of this impactite glass would form the smooth pebble shapes that are described by observers. Again, back to what people say, you see these smooth pebbles, you know, no bigger than a date in the cement. If you look at these things, Axon says, if the black stone fragments really are this fused silica glass from an impact, they shouldn't look like these smooth pebbles. They should they should have different surface features, including things like bubbles and vesicles. Mm-hmm. And so one last thought he offers is, you know, perhaps the original body was what he calls a concretation of pebbles. And so this original stone, when it fractured, what it was a bunch of pebbles stuck together, and it was just the pebbles coming off. Huh. If that makes any sense. So if you imagine the original stone was not like a solid stone that broke into pieces and then the pieces got smoothed down, what if it was a solid stone that was more like a cluster of grapes in okay. shape? And he cites one example of a piece of lunar material that had been hit by a shock meteorite bombardment that actually showed this type of this shape, that it looked sort of like a cluster of grapes. And so that's one possibility in his mind. But ultimately, he concludes, you know what? We don't know. And even though we've got better scientific knowledge to work with, we really need better access, if we're going to make a conclusion, just better access to the primary data. We'd have to be able to look at this thing closely and make some measurements.
Yeah, I really like that point that he made in the paper, saying that, you know, even at the time, what was this, 82, that the material sciences had advanced so much, even from some of the previous studies in the prior decades. And yet our information about the black stone itself has remained relatively the same. A few more subjective observations of what it consists of.
Yeah.
But ultimately no new information, certainly no scientifically analytic information.
Yeah, that is a good point. And I think one thing that I come away from this discussion with is, this attempt to investigate the material or geological character of the black stone strikes me as kind of similar to our episode from a couple years ago, or I guess, yeah, almost a couple, year and a half ago, maybe, mm-hmm. on the Will of the Wisp. In the same way, it encapsulates some of the difficulties of doing what you might call secondhand science. In both cases, you've got scientists trying to apply their knowledge of natural phenomena to match this wide range of disparate subjective reports. Now, I think the reports of the black stone of the Kaaba are much more substantive than those of the Will of the Wisp. Obviously, in the case of the Black Stone, it actually exists, and we know for a fact that it actually exists. It's not something that maybe people are just imagining. We know millions of people see it all the time. It's not an ephemeral phenomenon. It's like a thing that's there. It's widely observed. And we know that it's one unified phenomenon and not like different phenomena being reported under the same name. So these are all not the case for the Will of the Wisp, but like the Will of the Wisp, we have to make judgments based on a host of variable descriptions and characteristics. What color is it? Different reports say different things. Are there flecks of other colors within it? What color was it originally? Does it float in water? How reflective is it? Even in the cases where there's only one major answer to these, sometimes we don't know if we should trust that answer.
Or just throw out the question entirely.
Yeah. You know? Like, does it float in water? Are evidence that the stone floats in water is some report from 1,000 years ago?
Yeah. Like, should we give that more weight than the question, well, could it conceivably, you know, spout a mouth and start talking, you know? At what point do you just cut off and say, all right, we're only going to look at these three qualities.
What class of meteorite most commonly sprouts a tongue?
Ooh, I can't think of one offhand. We'll have to reach out to our audience on that one. Maybe the Inkarai meteorites.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if you do make a distinction between, subjective religious beliefs and just subjective direct observational reports, even the direct observational reports, they're giving us all this conflicting info, mm-hmm. and none of it's very solid. Like you're not taking a measurement of it. You're just saying like, yeah, here's generally what I saw.
Yeah.
But then there's one other interesting parallel. At least it seemed interesting to me here in talking about a religious object, is that I think it's kind of funny how the practice of trying to do a geological or material science analysis on the black stone based on these subjective descriptions almost reminds me of something that often happens in our faith traditions, which is the process of trying to draw clarity of theology from just what amounts to a large collection of stories. You know, so when theologians of almost any religion try to come up with the systematic theology of that religion, the systematic theology being, here are our beliefs, here are the mm-hmm. rules, here's what happens in the metaphysics of our religion, essentially the science of the religion.
Right.
They often have to draw these conclusions based on sources that are not originally written to be clear and systematic descriptions of rules and theological principles, but they're based on stories. And so you have to sift through the stories to try to pull out this clear systematic understanding of it all. Anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting.
No, I think, yeah, that's fair. It has the idea of taking all of these either tales or these accounts and trying to build something concrete out of it.
Or just to say, what does it mean?
Yeah. What is the shape of this? Or indeed, what is the meaning of this? Well, what am I supposed to take home from this?
Right.
But it's fascinating to look at these different scientific hypotheses about the Black Stone. It's also interesting just to look at the history and mythology surrounding it and try and figure out what that means as well. It's really an enigma on several different levels. And I hope that we've been able to relate some of that to you today. And on that note, hey, we're thinking about doing more episodes in this series, looking at sacred places or objects. So we should throw out the question, what sacred objects or places would you like us to cover in the future? We already have a few ideas kicking around.
Yeah, obviously, especially if there is some interesting scientific angle
that can be
discussed about it. One of the things that I might want to talk about in the future is the Ganges.
Oh, yes, that's a good one. More of an object than a place that comes to my mind is, of course, the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It's like nothing we've gone after before. so we should at least consider it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm sure there are some other examples out there that our listeners can think of, and certainly you can get in touch with us about those. And finally, you know, we've covered Islamic history, Islamic myth, Islamic scientific contributions on the show before and will again. And, you know, it's all part of our shared global culture. And at the same time, we recognize that discussions of Islamic culture continue to resonate with particular potency in today's political climate. So we encourage everyone out there to expand their understanding of what it means to be a Muslim in today's society. And as a starting point, we just wanted to highlight two organizations you might want to check out. First off, there's Muslims for Progressive Values at www.mpvusa.org. This is a faith-based grassroots international human rights organization that embodies and advocates for the traditional Quranic values of social justice and equality for all in the 21st century. So they champion such values as separation of religious and state authorities, freedom of speech, universal human rights, and gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
And another group is the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity, and that's at MuslimAlliance.org. So they work to support, empower, and connect LGBTQ Muslims. They seek to challenge root causes of oppression, including misogyny and xenophobia, and they aim to increase the acceptance of gender and sexual diversity within Muslim communities and to promote a progressive understanding of Islam that is centered on inclusion, justice, and equality.
Yeah, and one of the things that I hope always comes through whenever we talk about religions on this podcast, as we do fairly often, because I think we all sort of find them very interesting, is it can be very easy to talk about religions, especially a religion that you don't personally hold, in ways that are sort of overgeneralized and overdetermined.
Yeah.
And so one thing I hope you always take away from our discussions is the incredible room for diversity of opinion that exists within all these faith traditions around the world. There are a lot of ways to be a Christian, a lot of ways to be a Muslim, a lot of ways to be a Hindu or a Jew or anything.
Indeed. And, you know, I know we have some Muslim listeners out there, so we'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly if you have gone on the Hajj and you have seen the Black Stone with your own eyes or touched it with your own body, we would love to hear your account of that.
Yeah, what was it like? What do you think? And what color is it really?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that? You can find us online, as always, at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, videos, blog posts, and links out to our various social media accounts such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, etc.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
We'll be right back.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.